So we're kind of going on. I know we were off last week, but kind of continuing this concept of faithful parenting, right? Where when you are parenting, it's kind of helpful to have a goal. Now, the initial goal is just survival, right? So Lauren and David, what's your goal for Charlotte at this point? Keep her alive, right? That's all you want to do. And I think allow yourself to be sanctified in the effort, because you'll need that sanctification later on, right? But our goal in parenting is not necessarily the salvation of the children. It's not to protect them. It's not some expression of long-lost fantasies. We don't want them to be it's not to make them the athletes we never were, or to make them the performers we never were, or the academics we never were. I mean, the goal is to be faithful to what God has called you to do as a parent. Specifically, the parenting commands, right? And so we talked to, one of the obstacles to do, to really parenting faithfully is the spiritual state of your child, right? If you're going to parent for the glory of God, because he's worthy, you execute his commandments, one of the great obstacles is the spiritual state. So we talked a little bit about some of these passages, like Psalm 51, 5. I'm on page 5. Somebody want to read that? We'll take turns just kind of reading all this, just trying to bring the issue together. Psalm 51, 5. Who wants to read that?
Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me.
Okay. Genesis 6, 5. Josh, you want to get that?
The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually.
Okay. Jeremiah 17, 9. Andy.
The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it?
All right. And Kate, you want to get the long one, Romans 3, 10 through 18?
Sure. As it is written, none is righteous. No, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes.
Okay, then Ephesians 2:1. Corey, why don't you get that?
And you were dead in the trespasses and sins.
Okay. So the consensus is there's a very, very low opinion that God has about the human condition. Mm-hmm. Right? All have sinned, right? You never have to teach people how to be selfish. They tend to pick it up naturally. Mm-hmm. And so this is all of these verses feed what's called the doctrine of total depravity. Okay? Now, there's a difference between what I call total depravity and total depravity. Okay, total depravity is that humans are as bad as they could possibly be. Right, that every human is as bad as they could possibly be. Now, is that true?
No.
No. Okay. What are you going to say? Want to elaborate on that, David?
What's that?
Elaborate on that.
Well, just that total depravity is like complete contamination.
Yeah.
Whereas being completely depraved, that person would have to be locked up or put down. Mm-hmm. Because they would absolutely do every evil thing they could possibly do at every moment.
Yeah.
And I think it was R.C. Sproul gave the illustration of taking a glass of water. Mm-hmm. It's like 99.99, like think about 9,000 drops of water in it. Mm-hmm. And then one drop of potassium cyanide stirred up with a straw and said, hey, look, this is mostly pure. Mm-hmm. Have a sip, you know.
Yeah. And that's part of it. It's like we've all been corrupted, okay?
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that we are as bad as we could possibly be. Not everyone's destined to be a Jeffrey Dahmer, okay? But one, depraved people cannot or do not perform actions that are good. It does not mean that depraved people cannot or do not perform actions that are good in either God, man's side or God's side. So like one good action would be, remember when King Cyrus decreed that the Jews should return to Jerusalem? I mean, that was a good action where God used Cyrus to accomplish his good. Right? Depravity does not mean that God can't use bad people to do good things. Right? You have the concept of common grace. Secondly, it does not mean that fallen man has no conscience which judges between good and evil for him. Right? There are some who don't, like your sociopath, but mankind does have a conscience. Or that people indulge in every form of sin or in any sin to the greatest extent possible. Now, for some people it does, but not in all cases. But I think what it does mean is that there's nothing man can do to merit saving favor with God. Right? Even our good deeds have some mild form of corruption. I like the idea of like the one drop of cyanide, right? It contaminates every water molecule. So when we look at this, okay, and this will be a fun discussion. This will be a good good one to share with all you people who do not have children yet. But how does sin commonly manifest itself in children? Okay, brainstorm.
Defiance.
Yes, at every age. At every age. I remember my wife used to tell me when I wanted to tolerate some sin in my children, like when they were three, she said, imagine what this will look like if you put a 1 in front of that 3 or a 1 in front of that 4. I'm like, better deal with it. So defiance, right? What else?
Selfishness.
Yeah. Selfishness, uh-huh.
Lying.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's almost this awakening where I don't have to tell you the truth. I actually remember the first time I think I really consciously, it's one of my early childhood memories. We were living in Arizona at the time, and I would always go out and play in the sandbox by myself because I had two older sisters. I had no brother at the time. And my mom called me in, and I just thought, you know what? Maybe this time is going to be different. Maybe this time I don't need to go in. And so my mom came out and she brandished a wooden spoon. And I thought, you know, I don't have to just let this woman spank me. I can just run away. And I remember actually running around the swing set and kind of doing the type of thing with her. And she tracked me down and she spanked me. And I thought, well, that didn't work. I mean, there are times when, like, our kids would just go on hunger strikes. I'm sorry, Dad, but I cannot eat those scrambled eggs. It doesn't matter what you do, I will spit it out every time. I'm sorry, it's just the way. I mean, it's almost like this transaction, right? It's kind of, I don't know. You know what I'm saying, Scott? I mean,
yeah. Yeah, it's almost a part of their. Like, as they grow up, you see that although their heart is, you know, sinful from the beginning, it's like they're testing and figuring out all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, they try a different facial expression, you know, different cry, different tactic each time.
How far can I go?
To try to figure things out.
A tantrum doesn't get me what I want at home. Yeah. But what about a tantrum at Walmart? Would that be a different result? How about a tantrum with a full cart at Walmart? Maybe that will give me what I want. Corey, you are...
Memories.
You said it all. Right? And so they're always kind of poking and doing all that, too.
But I think, like, you know, I think about your example of, like, as parents, we talked again about, like, what... How do we correct certain behavior? And when is it? We use the term spankable offense. And so, like, with, you know, with our last one, with our youngest, it's just after a while you can see that when you tell him to do something specifically, he's constantly calculating what am I going to have to do? And he's watching for the slightest inclination that he's going to receive some sort of discipline. So can I use this tone of voice? Can I delay? He's like got a timer going off in his head. How long can I wait before, you know? And so there's a sense of he's trying to, you know, the children will grasp as much authority and control as they can.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've seen it, right? Other ways that sin manifests itself in children?
Manipulation.
Manipulation.
Using adults against one another.
Mm-hmm.
In surprisingly complex ways.
Mm-hmm. David?
Just thinking about, thinking about, you know, transactional. Wow, they're actually doing something that they know I wanted them to do, not realizing that it's a setup because they got something they want to do, you know.
Yeah.
So
I'm being buttered up.
Exactly. So we have that people pleasing element, but it's, you know, working it to some advantage,
mm-hmm.
So, which is kind of in that line of that bit of evil that's kind of mixed in with the good so that it's not tainted.
Yeah.
I said lazy.
Yeah, laziness?
Yeah.
Yes, that is a tough one to deal with.
Well, even violence.
Yeah. I mean, it's a gang war zone in the toddler classroom.
Well, my sister, she's handicapped, mentally handicapped. When we were kids, she put everything in her mouth, and she would take my Hot Wheels and put them in her mouth, and she was like crazy strong, and I could never get them away from her, so I would just beat the crap out of her to get my Hot Wheel back. She would just laugh at me. She didn't care.
So. Older and younger sister?
Younger.
Okay, God's done a great work in you, Scott. It comes out in all kinds of surprising ways. So, David, Lauren, be ready. This is the most well-behaved she will ever be. Right? So, what's the problem with believing that your children are born good? I mean, how would this impact your parenting? So, kind of define it, two further questions. If you believe that children were born good, what would you see as their greatest need?
Protection.
Protection.
Put them in a bubble, keep the evil outside, precious little deer inside,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, as long as we insulate them with enough layers of bubble wrap, they're not going to turn into a pint-sized serial killer.
Yeah. Yep.
I think there's secular, from the high school, that it's not necessarily a believing that they're born good, but that they're like a blank slate type thing. Like, their greatest thing is to be taught. If we just teach them, and that translates through all the parenting. Well, they're doing that bad because they don't know any better. And so I just need to teach them it's right to do this and it's wrong to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember my first exposure to, like, real Christianity was, I was in the third grade and made a friend with Mark, who lived in my neighborhood, and his story was he was born premature, and his parents basically made the deal with God, right, that if you answer our prayer and save our child, we will live forever. You know, we will commit ourselves to become Christians and follow you. And his mom took it really seriously. So initially he was in public school, then he went to Christian school, then he went to homeschool. And this was during the 80s when homeschool was just started. And I go over to his house, and his mom was watching Praise the Lord TV every day. Like, she would actually put her hands on the screen. I mean, so she was a charismatic Christian, loved Tammy Faye Baker. I mean, who remembers the Baker family, right? It was a spectacle. But what was also interesting is, so obviously the homeschooling choices were there. They ate organic everything. Like, they didn't have sugar in the house. You had to put honey on stone ground bran flakes. For a treat, they would have carob chip cookies. right? So it was just like this sterile thing. But I mean, there was something attractive about them because they were very committed and everything. But when the mom was gone, I'd spend the night. He would just tell me filthy joke after filthy joke, and I was no angel too. I mean, I would tell my stash as well. You know what I'm saying? But it was just one of those things where, as protected as he was, I mean, he still had that impulse within him, right?
Yeah, I think it also it misplaces the focus, because people that believe their children are born good, they still see the evil, and so they're like, where do they learn this? And looking at their preschool, and they're looking at their daycare, and they're looking at, are they watching TV too much?
Yeah.
It's like, I've got to find the root that's causing this behavior.
Yeah. And that's just it. I mean, if one of those children in this kind of environment rebels, I mean, how do you explain it?
We missed something. Mm-hmm. What got in? Where did the contagion come from?
Yeah.
Who else's fault is it?
Mm-hmm. Need to regulate their friends.
Mm-hmm.
We need to not watch TV. I mean, just take away, confiscate the screens. You know what I'm saying? I mean, so that's kind of where this kind of parenting can go. All right? And you can kind of understand that, right? But if you think that evil is from without instead of within, you're going to have a different strategy. I mean, so how do many parents, like in this day and age, why do many parents seek to shelter their children from evil, and how do they do so? And granted, is it wrong to want to shelter your kids from evil?
No.
No,
there's nothing wrong with
that. Nothing wrong with that. So, I mean, what are some maybe good ways that we try to shelter our kids from evil?
No, you're not going to watch that NC-17 rated movie.
For instance. Okay. I mean, what do you guys do, maybe in your household, what do you guys do? We have things we do, which I'll share when you guys all do.
My parents were really big on, like, I could always have friends over at our house,
mm-hmm.
But they were very particular about whose house I could spend the night at.
Okay.
Basically, like, only church friends I could ever really spend the night at, but I could have any of my friends over, and that was totally fine. And
advantage, exactly. Other things?
My parents, they do the street light. Then when the street light comes on.
Yeah. That was before cell phones, right? When the sun went down, you needed to be home. We had like these time markers. Yeah, I was amazed at how much we ran free as kids.
Compared to now,
And you always hear about missing children, right? Like, oh man, it's too dear, but that's the cost of freedom, so I guess we'll some other way. What are some other ways? Like, same, you know, just ways you might shelter your kids.
Who they hang out with?
Mm-hmm.
New TV shows.
Shows.
Be like, is this one okay to watch, Mom?
The answer is
no.
We always have a limit on the amount of time. One great thing about having basically the worst internet in the world is, it's like, you can watch that loading wheel forever, so that's fine. So they've discovered books and music, and it's kind of cool.
There's this thing called a CD.
Yeah.
Plastic discs with magical properties. You put in this machine and it's like, I know for us, we have done a lot as far as internet content, right? Like my son Nathan has a Gab phone, and a Gab phone can do texting, phone calls, check your calendar. There's a tracking device on it. And then you can play MP3s that you download. And there's a calculator. That's it. Those are all the apps. And so, he can't look at porn on that machine if he wanted to, right? So we do a lot of, so we have like a bunch of internet protocols and other things to make sure that our kids can't if they wanted to. And part of that is we just understand the corrupting influence of porn and just what that does to the mind and how they objectify to the other person. So yeah, we do shelter people. And we're unapologetic about it.
Yeah, and I think it, a lot of it we found sometimes the way in which you go about it may, and the particular things you shelter them from might be shaped by your own childhood. And, you know, if you were sheltered from something, and or if you were not sheltered at all, you're going to have different approaches as to what. And many times you kind of want the other thing. If you, if you grew up totally unsheltered, you're going to want more protection for your children, where if you grew up completely closed in, you might want a little bit more freedom and accountability type of stuff. I mean, it's hard to sometimes keep from reacting to that style of parenting that you faced. Whether or not your parents were believers, there's just a lot of looking at that, because that tends to be, we tend to parent like we were parented.
Or in response to it, like if your parents are letting you run free, which was probably more my parents. I was amazed at the stuff I was able to get away with. I kind of reacted against that.
They trusted me a little.
They trusted me too much, because as they thought this was going on, this was the reality, right? I mean, so it is, I mean, I'd even say, let's say schooling. You know, a lot of times people will choose the schooling option because they want to shelter their kids. So when does sheltering go too far? You know what I'm saying? Like, we all do it to a certain extent. Like, you don't let your kids play with knives. So when does it go too far?
I think if you don't educate your children as to why you're doing it, then the human curiosity kicks in and they do it anyway. So use pornography, for example. They can't watch it at your house, and I'm sure you guys have educated them, but if you didn't, then all of a sudden it becomes, why? Why can't I watch this? So I'll go to my friend's house and watch it. But if you educate, or try to educate your children as to why you're telling them no, then hopefully you have a better chance of them not going down that road.
I
think along with that, if you don't give them an opportunity to discern for themselves and come across a certain situation, you know, if they're not held responsible to a point on their own, how they know what they're taught is, you know, valuable. They don't actually get put in that scenario situation where they have to make a choice.
Good insight. Other thoughts?
Well, as far as the, you know, when has it gone too far, is I feel like, you know, am I raising a bonsai? You know, I don't want to keep clipping the roots and clipping everything to where they just can't grow, where they're just going to be stuck somewhere. Yesterday was a terrifying day for me, because they dropped off a little small tractor, and by the end of the day, all three boys had driven it and had scooped up load of dirt and moved it and stuff, all three of them. So there's that point where I'm like, you know,
what your boys would
this
do with
be
a
today,
tractor
and then
is intriguing.
What's that?
What your boys would do with an tractor is pretty intriguing.
Yeah, well, one of the things,
dirt mounds from space.
I turn and I see Chris is driving, and Aiden's trying to keep there and tell him what to do, standing on the three-pointer. Which, you know, holding on to the rocks and talking to him while they're driving. Okay. So,
I mean, from my experience, you know, rules without a relationship can exasperate people.
Yes.
You know, I think one of the big things that the biggest sheltering tactic that I think every parent should take advantage of is a natural relationship with their kids. You know what I'm saying? Where there's a free back and forth and stuff like that. There's kind of like, I'm not sure what my dad would think, and I care about his opinion. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's also misguided to think that people can be sanctified by rules, right? Isn't that what the Pharisees did? You know, there's this rule, but to make sure that we don't cross over, we need to make this rule and this rule to make sure that we don't go there.
And there's also just the idea that you can keep sin out of your kid. I mean, the sin is there, and so you know you're basically trying to put less fuel on a fire that's already burning inside of their heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so that trying to prevent much more damage than you know the damage that's already there because of sin.
Yeah.
And so you know, and then I think the other thing with relationship is, and like you know, thinking about you know how to deal with what you're telling them not to do. I think there's the idea that your best defense sometimes is the good offense. You know, having a good relationship, a good marriage, a good interaction with your kids, giving them always the positive that should displace the sinful.
Yeah.
So godly friends and you know godly. You know, experience at church where they're involved, they have social interaction. They have a good positive outlet and they can see the way that they ought to live is sometimes the best defense because I guess you know when you I don't know, use a food example, like when you eat something that's really, really good, you kinda lose the taste for those things that don't really compare.
I'm so full of ribeye that I don't have space for Doritos.
Yes.
Glad you like that, Kate. That's a good ribeye. It really is.
Yeah, I think there's also a point to where you have to allow them to experience the world in a controlled environment.
Yeah.
Because if you shelter them so much, Satan's really good at making the world look amazing and so fun and so, you know, you're and lying to you and saying, oh, well, your parents were holding you back and all and stuff like that. So you kind of have to allow them to make mistakes and to experience the world, but keeping them safe while they're doing it, which is probably really
hard. We did something edgy when our kids were younger. I mean, Julie was 10 and Jake might have been 5. And we were cooking with beer. And so we got some Dixie cups. Poured it around. You guys want to try beer?
Shots.
Sure. And so we have it on video. It was awesome. And they just went, ooh. And then Jake said the magic words, I'm never drinking beer again. There you go, kids. There's no commercials. There's no creative geniuses that get people to actually want to drink this, right? But that's like an example of a controlled environment. You know, what does beer taste like? Beer you go. And they'll remember how awful beer tastes. Now, they don't know that people drink beer for other reasons, but we just wanted to do the taste part. And I think the other thing is, like, when your kids sin, right, if you take this sheltering approach, what's going to be your solution?
More sheltering.
More sheltering. Lean into sheltering. But if you understand depravity as the issue, what's going to be your approach?
Correction.
Hold them responsible, but what else?
You focused on the heart, not the behavior.
Not the behavior. And so then what will you do?
Turn them to the Bible.
Turn to the Bible and specifically?
Repentance.
Repentance and the gospel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. This what this is showing me is that you really need a new heart. Right? You need a new heart. And that's the problem with sheltering parenting is when you think you instead of saying you need more rules and yeah and the rules are for their benefit right like keeping your kids from porn I mean that's you're doing them a favor right that's going to help them in the future but ultimately when they do fail it's like what is the plan for failure in this parenting philosophy the plan for failure in a sheltering philosophy is more rules. The plan for failure in a faithful parenting philosophy is you take them to the gospel.
And we found, and this became clear to us with each kid, is that the more, like, that those times of addressing the heart, the more clear you can be about just bringing up what God's righteousness looks like, and how often they sin, and how the sin is in their heart, in their mind. Like, it becomes clearer, like, the gospel is just crystal clear, and it makes sense. Like, they know that they sin, they know they can't stop sinning, they know that it's wrong, and they need help, right? And then, when they you know, I think it's just powerful when your kids, there's a point at which, like when they're really young, they're like, I'll obey, mm-hmm. I'll do better, I'll change, you know, like they go through this thing that I think maybe I was in my 20s, you know, when I was realizing, oh, I can't actually. And at a very young age, they can just grasp that I am a sinner who cannot save myself. And so then they're just perfectly, you know, they can hear the gospel and that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a very key concept, right? It's, you know, the solution is not more rules, but having a rightly ordered relationship with the Lord.
Yeah.
Right. And so they kind of keep that in mind. So the rules are not bad as long as you keep them in perspective. And your I think you know you've gone too far when your instinct is to create more rules, not address that issue. Okay. And that's not to say that maybe more rules need to be in place, right? But you just realize that rules, all you can do is just restrain it. Right? Eventually it's, you know, they have to have a new heart. And that's what you need to point people to. So does depravity of man necessarily mean that your children will be as bad as they can be? What impact can a Christian parent make?
They can always surprise you with how much further they can go.
With how much what?
How much further they can go.
Yeah.
You know, like, nope, we ain't found the bottom yet, and we're not gonna.
Yeah. I want to take you to a passage I think is, I mean, it's a real fascinating one, okay? It's 1 Corinthians 7:14. And in the context, Paul's talking about rightly ordered marriage relationships within the church. And here he is appealing to a believer who's married to an unbeliever to stay married. Okay, somebody want to read that for me? 7:14.
The unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean. But as it is, they are holy.
They are holy, okay. That's an interesting passage with some really fascinating parenting implications. So in the context, Paul argues that a believing wife should stay married to her unbelieving husband so that her children will be made holy. In light of this, what would happen to the children if the believing spouse left? What does the text say?
Unclean.
They would be unclean. Okay. So what's the difference between the holiness discussed in 1 Corinthians 7:14 and the holiness which accompanies salvation? When would it be able to discern the difference? So, I mean, what do you mean by holy? Yeah.
Set aside for the service of the Lord, set aside as a member of faith community, but not holy in and of themselves. Holy positionally, not holy in identity.
Okay. What do you think, David?
Yes, I was thinking that the reason that the non-Christian spouse is set on that same shelf as being set apart so that the children can also be, you know, kept in that place where they're receiving the nurturing and they're included in the church. They're not like cast out, or they're not somehow, you know, that's how I see that. I do not see it as the holiness of God, where he is so set apart and so other that it's unattainable except for what he did to make himself attainable. You know, he came to us. So, but yeah, I think that's...
Well, look at this. I mean, for the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife. What does that...
Presence of one spouse being a believer is enough, because all things work together for good for those who love God, and one being in that married relationship is a connection to the whole family.
Okay.
I know that my Uncle Jerry was not a believer for at least 30 years.
Okay.
But his wife was.
Okay.
And she was this beautiful. Kathy's, she's still alive. Jerry's passed away.
Mm-hmm.
But I watched Jerry be transformed by her and by finally receiving the gospel. Mm-hmm. He had seen his faithful wife all those years, mm-hmm. and it had an effect on him. He watched it happen with his children, you know, and saw the effect of their mother. Mm-hmm. And all of those things leading to a very devoted pastor who came alongside and was there. You know, it was amazing to watch him born again.
Didn't you guys have unbelieving parents? Okay. So, when you have kids, how did your unbelieving parents... Well, I'll just tell you kind of my experience, okay? So my parents weren't believers at the time when we first had our kids, okay? But it was very clear. They knew that we were raising our kids and that we were in the church of the Lord. And we never prayed before meals. Never prayed before meals. But guess what became a new custom? Right? We would pray before meals because that's what the grandkids did. Does that make sense? It was amazing how my parents cleaned up their language. I mean, they were not cussing like sailors, but they had a new awareness that, oh, we got to... You see what I'm saying? And so if you are a believer who's married to an unbeliever, and the unbeliever decides that they want to stay married to you, there will be some residual impact on them. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not sure. So when you talk about the holiness of an unbeliever, this is not the holiness of... They're not saints, right? They're not positionally holy. But there has been some sanctifying, right? You're the salt of the earth, right?
It'll be an influence.
It'll be an influence.
And then, you know, even the people that won't have... There'll be a provoking of good works there because they will have that influence and they'll see it.
Yeah.
And therefore that will permeate into it. And that's kind of basically what the... husband and wife situation there, you know, don't leave because, you know, basically there's an opportunity, a mission field there through your testimony.
There is kind of a restraint of evil, right? Like Christians in society, we restrain evil in many ways for the rest of society from the fullest extent. I think even in a marriage, there's a restraint and impact on the kids. So it's a real, I mean, I think this is very encouraging though, right? Like if you're married to an unbeliever, you know, your kids may not believe the gospel. Right, they may not be positional saints, but there is something to be said that their behavior is sanctified. Yeah.
I was thinking about, I mean, for me, the old man, mm-hmm. I have a new nature to me, but I have an old nature. Mm-hmm. That old nature is that non-Christian spouse. The Holy Spirit comes in bringing a new nature. Mm-hmm. The Holy Spirit is that spouse who mm-hmm. is preaching to my heart, who is mm-hmm. giving me a new way of looking at things, who is absolutely not tolerating sin, who, mm-hmm. you know, but is so gentle and so, mm-hmm. you know, winning and winsome. And mm-hmm. my old nature is still going to be there, unfortunately, mm-hmm. until I die.
Yeah,
but it's totally being subdued,
mm-hmm. yeah.
tamed, brought under control.
Yeah. So I mean, if you have, let's say, a friend who you know, you convert, and you guys, you know, they always tell you dirty jokes and whatever. If he still wanted to be your friend, right? He would probably stop doing that because he knows it makes you really uncomfortable. Now, if you have a friend who he wants to do that and he's really turned off by you, he won't be your friend anymore. So in this case, if the spouse wants to stay married, you know, often they will compromise and bend a few things to kind of accommodate that, you know, in your life. And honestly, even with kids, right, even if kids aren't believers, I mean, you know, the parents are the most important people in their lives. You know, so there will be a season where they'll always want to do things to be close to you, right, and do all these things because they, you know, you're their hero in a lot of ways. And so there is some informal leverage that the Lord gives people that will impact their behavior. Does that make sense? So I think he's just kind of recognizing the way things are. So, I mean, so in general, question three, what does this passage, the above passage, teach about how children will respond to their parents' faith? they respond? Nate, what do you think? You were about to say something, but...
Yeah. They will... There's a greater chance that they will come to know God.
Yeah. They want to honor it, because they will want to be like you.
Right.
And those were great, glorious days in my parenting. You guys ever seen The Croods?
Yeah.
Where there's this 10-year-old son who just openly worships his dad, and I just love that dynamic, because it just kind of captures that. It changes when they hit 12, but you know, when between 8 and 10, those were the golden years. I'd be watching a game, and yeah, Nathan would say, "Oh, who's playing?" And I'd say, "These two teams." "So, who are you rooting for?" "That team." "Okay, they score a touchdown." "Yes!" You know, it's just, that's all he needed. That's all he needed, right? Remember those great days, Scott? You still have those with them.
Yeah.
But when you pick another team that you're not rooting for, you're like...
Yeah, it's just that they, you know, and you're kind of getting into it here in a bit, but like, no matter what, you know, how you're leading and what your specifics are, you know, your kids are going to want to be like you.
Yeah.
They're going to learn what it's like to be a man or a woman from their mom and their dad, you know, and they're just, that's their whole world in a sense.
Yeah. It is. I mean, parents have an unbelievable amount of influence, right?
And I think it's encouraging that I think, you know, many times that the secular and the lost world greatly, you know, overestimates, you know, governmental forces and societal institutions, and greatly underestimates the powerful role of the family in the church, and that really, if you have a strong family, I mean, it has more power to help your child than any other agency in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think people kind of buy into this fiction that because the schools are going this way, and the university is going this way, and the media is going this way, and entertainment is going this way, that it's just inevitable that your kids are going to, you know, just join the movement.
But none of that, I mean, there's no match against good...
For instance, with media, how powerful is the media? As powerful as you'd like it to be. Because there's this thing called an off button. You know what I'm saying? And even with like different schooling options that we have now that we didn't have before, right? There's other... I mean, I even look at... now, a lot of times, college, you can all be done online. Right? You can get a degree online. And so the campus culture, I mean, there's very little that they can do. You know what I'm saying? So parents have... So I kind of look, we can be dispirited about the way this culture is going, but the fact is, conservative Christians, we are more than repopulating our numbers, and we are more than replenishing our numbers, right? For the secular population to grow, they have to basically steal kids from us and put them into the cause, right? In Europe, you're going to have a massive transformation. Europe is going to become more conservative because the Muslims... and committed Muslims are repopulating. It's not the secular Europeans. Right, so watch, 50 years, Europe was going to be a different continent, different values, Sharia law, all that stuff will be seriously entertained in places where you can't believe it's going to be. Yeah.
Something that I'm dealing with the boys right now, because they're older, and you know, the days of, you know, spankings and that sort of thing, you know, those are long gone. So now the appeal is using things that happen, and we'll refer back to something else. But one of the things that has been real helpful is I've been talking to them about Moses and David. Both of those were men who learned the ways of God. Mm-hmm. They loved him for his ways. Mm-hmm. The people, those millions of people in the wilderness, they knew the works of God.
Mm-hmm.
They knew his works. They saw his deeds. They saw these miraculous things happen.
Yeah.
But they didn't know God's heart. And so in one generation, they could be flipped.
Yeah.
Or in 1 week or 1 day, they could just entertain things that they shouldn't do.
Yeah.
And in the parenting thing, what I've talked to the boys about is, do you want to live in this house and we have to have 3,000 rules about all the different things we have to do? Or you just need to become aware of what it takes to keep a house clean and safe and whatever. And then you just do those things and nobody ever has to tell you.
Yeah.
You might even do things differently than I do them, but when I look at it, go, that was a good idea. You know?
Yeah, and there is something too where the rules do benefit, right? Like they have, you know, done studies that if you graduate, you go from high school, you get a high school degree, and then you get married, and then have a baby in this order.
Yeah.
Right? No baby here, but high school degree, married, have a baby, you won't be in poverty.
Right.
Right. Overwhelming studies show that, right? High school, married, then baby. And there is a sense that if you follow, let's say, the Proverbs and some of the rules of Christianity,
sure,
you will flourish in some way, right? It does lead to that. Now, that is not enough to save you. But I think there is a sanctification that happens with the Christian influence.
Yes.
And this is why it's important too, but it's also important to understand, okay, question G, why is it important to understand that external conformity is distinct from true biblical saving faith? Why is it important to make that distinction?
Because, you know, I don't think Satan cares whether you're in the left ditch or the right ditch. Mm-hmm. You can be the younger brother or the older brother. He just doesn't want you on the path.
Yeah. Because you might be tempted to take some of these external conformities and they're making good decisions and say, that must mean they are saved. Mm-hmm. Right? Where in reality, what's happening? Yeah, and there's category. There's good Christian sins. May not be, they might be the older brother, not the younger brother, right? So if you only think that the sinners are the younger brothers, the prodigal son that I'm talking about, instead of the older brother sins, like self-righteousness, critical judgmentalism, all that stuff, I mean, that can alienate you from God in even more severe ways, right? Where ultimately, you know, God's not enough for you. You need these rules. You have a sense of self-righteousness. So what's the danger of assuring your children they are saved when in reality they may simply be sanctified by your presence in their lives? What's the danger of giving them that assurance?
And they'll continue to believe it later in life when they really aren't saved.
Yeah.
They have a different gospel message, not the truth.
Yeah.
The story of you, the gospel.
Yeah, I think they need to kind of wrestle with that.
So their faith will be based on their parents' faith and not on God.
Maybe based off of a moment. Well, I prayed a prayer when I was six, so like, I must be saved.
Right.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times we, you know, it's hard to watch kids wrestle with that. Yeah.
They won't be prepared for failure. They'll have the external conformity, but it'll be a very beautiful house built on sand because it's not built on the truth of the gospel.
Yeah.
When the bad times do come, they'll fold and say, wow, it was all a lie, it was all false.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did all this for nothing. What a waste.
Yeah. So, I mean, many parents agonizing over the lost state of their children are tempted to take any slight hints of spiritual life as proof that they are born again. They might be tempted to give assurance to their children so their own anxieties are relieved. When we do this, we are in effect seeking to save our children by broadening the umbrella of the gospel to include them. Essentially, we declare our children saved before God does. Yet, a proper understanding of total depravity makes it clear that even the best behaved children are not acceptable before God. They, like the little terror across the street, need the sovereign work of grace in their lives, one which will give a new heart. This brings us to the next point. So we'll pause there. Whose job is it to save our children? And where are we meeting next week? In a new building, right? It is being put to use. Let me pray. Well, Father, I do thank you for this class, and I pray that you'll just sanctify all our children, Lord, not just so that they might flourish in this world, but so that they might be saved and inherit the world to come. I pray for this next part of the worship service, Lord, that will be honoring to you, that will be encouraged by the fellowship and the teaching and all the good things you have for us. In Christ's name, amen.